million. A judge, in the meantime, has allowed the administration to continue to deploy the military in L.A. as the case works its way through the courts. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
This is live in Iowa City.
I've been in love with Iowa City ever since I was born.
The feeling of family, the feeling of knowing, have some identity, who you are. And that's why people who leave Iowa City, they come back all the time, don't they? They can move out, but that don't stop them from coming back. They're there every day, aren't they? And you know why they do that? Because that's home for them.
My name is Geraldine Cruz.
How long have you been living around Iowa City?
Ever since 1976.
Do you like Iowa City?
Yes.
What are the things you like about Iowa City?
Look at me. She like me from Iowa City, right?
It's a community of different people, and it's about love.
Camille has a big place in our heart. Some people will say, no, not me, but if you didn't, you wouldn't be here right now.
This is a house that Jack built, y'all. Remember this house. This was the land that he worked by hand. It was the dream of an upright man.
My father was on a farm, and until he decided that he didn't want to farm anymore, and he packed us all up, and we came to Washington, D.C. At first, we visited our aunt in Georgetown. On 23rd Street, she had a house there, but we couldn't stay there because it wasn't big enough. So anyhow, so we came to Iowa City, and there Mr. Wooden, who had his children had kind of grown up, and he allowed us to stay there for a few days until my father was able to get himself a place where we could stay.
You know, years ago, the people used to come to the city, and then the others would come and stay with them. And then once they got positioned, then they would get their own homes. I understand that's the way they did from the South. My father had, a couple of cousins. And later on, when we were established, my father's brother came and lived with us. My father's sister came and lived with us until they got established.
Back during that time when black people were slaves, I think they came from Fredericksburg, Virginia, up to Washington. And from what I understand, my great uncle who built the house, which was 1828 Providence Street, which is where I lived just last year, right up to April of 2005, he built the home. I believe he worked on the railroad.
Most of the women in Iowa City worked, if they didn't do work in the homes for the people. Most of them worked at the laundry, and the men worked on the railroad or whatever.
Oh, my mother worked at Wilkins Coffee. She was packing coffee back in the old days. My father was an automobile mechanic. He worked at the Greyhound bus station on New York Avenue in Kendall Street Northeast.
The way my dad got up here is that the man that, my grandfather, his father was a sharecropper, and if you know how that works, it's set up so that you will never own the property. But because my grandfather had so many children and that he took care of other people's children during the Depression, he was able to work it out and own his own land. And he owned a tremendous amount of land. Well, anyway, the man that had to sell him the land still used to extort produce or product from the property. and my grandfather wasn't going for it, and some kind of argument happened out in one of the fields or something like that. It resulted in my grandfather getting shot, not killed though. He died later of the wounds, but a long time later. He must have had diabetes or something, because the wound went unhealed for a very long time. My father apparently beat the crap out of the son that was there and the man that they got the farm from. And it was raining the night when the Klan came to my dad's house, and they ran away, and my mother's firstborn caught pneumonia because it was raining, and he died. And she never talked about him. The whole situation just tore up. And that's how they came to D.C., because my mother's brother lived here. And it was sort of like coming refuge. And they rented a house up there on Capitol Avenue where the park is now in 1938.
Before we was here, we lived in Southeast on Southern Avenue, but it was a lot of violence came around there. So we decided to come around Ivy City, and we moved around here in 2005.
I've done a little bit of genealogical research. I have a girlfriend from my high school days around here who's still in town, who's very interested in her own family. So I've been looking a lot on genealogy.com and Cindy's List and other like genealogy websites. The best thing that I can surmise is that my grandmother, and I'll share pictures with you if I can find them later on, I have some, looked like a Chinese lady and passed herself off as that. I believe that she, well, in finding papers from the census in like 1900 and 1920, that she was listed as mulatto. I believe she was African American and American Indian, and that she had very fair skin, jet black hair, and like what I would say were black eyes. She just looked very, they were very very high cheekbones and very Asian features. I think she was an American Indian. In southern counties in Virginia, mixed race marriages were very frowned upon. I think that black people had just come out of slavery, so they didn't have it too good, and I think Indians were considered furniture. I don't think they were considered as human beings. And so I think that they probably moved to Washington, D.C. from, I'm going to say, not the Carolinas, but from Virginia. That's where I think their people are from. That they're, it was for safety, you know, the safety of being in this, the federal city with all the new laws and what Lincoln did. I just felt that, I think they probably felt more protected here than they would have in Virginia in a mixed race marriage like that.
I was born right here in this community on Montello Avenue, Northeast. And I was delivered by, at my home, I was born at home by a Dr. Smith, who was the community doctor, and he was well thought of in the community, and most of the people used him as their doctor.
These arms of mine, they are yearning.
Aaron John Ayler, and my mom is Rita E. Gray, her married name is Ayler, and she and her mom were antique dealers, and they're from Ivy City. I was born on August 25th, 1964 at Sibley Hospital in Washington, D.C., and I lived at 1835 Kendall Street, Northeast, from the time I think I was about 6 or 7 until I left at about 17 or 18 years old. Because, my childhood growing up in Ivy City and just in general was just, it was a rough childhood. And I got out of here and moved up to New Jersey and got involved in technology and pretty much stayed there, made a career there, got married there, had a kid there, got divorced there, and didn't come back to Washington. I'd always miss Washington because it's my favorite city on the planet. It's where I'm from and the best place. I didn't come back until after 9/11, which pretty much, in my opinion, ruined New Jersey's economy and the Northeast. I think it really hurt a lot of people. And I had a good technology job at Dow Jones, publishing the Wall Street Journal. And that went away, along with a lot of other people. And I had visited my mom and, you know, seen that she had, she has breast cancer, and her level of independence was being threatened, you know, by her disability. And I decided to move back to Washington. I just have always loved it here. It was a hard decision. I've never lived more than an hour away from my son for the first 9 years of his life, so it was a very hard decision, but I feel like it was the really the best one for me. And my life, my circle seemed to immediately expand after I got back here. I ran into Parisa, these folks doing crazy stuff in Ivy City, taking care of my mom. She needed that. I know it really has been a benefit to her and to me to learn more about, you know, my heritage. I really didn't know a lot about it, and I've certainly gotten an education over the last 2 years that I've been back.
My father worked for the district government. He worked for the environment, the trash collectors. In fact, at the time, that was mainly one of the most jobs that the colored person would have for the district government.
I was married when I got drafted, too. And which they shouldn't have done, because I had four children. My wife had four kids when I got drafted, and they wasn't drafting. The first woman drafting, no married, and they always told me the same old lie. I'll never forget this. Oh, coach, don't worry. You get out at the next camp, and the next camp never came. But I end up in Korea too. I was over there at the same time my brother got killed. They put the race issue on you back there. And that's what happened. I didn't get back home to my brother's film. Not which I was supposed to come home to his film. I didn't get back home to his film. And I never gave the country for that.
The history of it is that, and y'all don't know this, you young black kids, y'all don't know that. Y'all pay attention, man. Y'all gonna do this, all right? Black people weren't allowed to do too many things, okay? There's certain jobs we couldn't have, and there was places that we couldn't go. So that's why Ivy City was so important, because it was an all-black part of the city. We called all the grown-ups uncle and aunt, even though they may not have been any kin to us.
And if you would let them hold you, oh, I'll breathe.
I'm proud of being Ivy City. That's why I purchased this building here. It was a gift from heaven above. I was able to get it at a proper price that I was able to pay because of the fact that I saved my money. I lived in this building 25 years before I purchased it. I bought the building under the tenant's first right to purchase it for $40,000 5 years ago.
It was really weird because the banks would not loan my parents any money, even though they had stellar credit. But the Lord works in mysterious ways. I went to my credit union. I was only 19 years old at the time. And I was working for what was called HEW, I think it's called Health and Human Services these days. And I went to the credit union and explained the situation, and they gave me the money. So I was able to buy my first house when I was 19 years old.
My name is Marjorie Dean Jones. And I have been a resident of Ivy City from 3 years old up until I was 11. No more tears to be cried, and we have finally dried our eyes. I said, we're moving on up. My mother and father both are from Columbia, South Carolina, and they came to Washington, D.C. at the age, my father was 17 and my mother was 17. They both were born in 1905. When they came to Washington, my father got a job at the Union Station as a red cap. My mother never worked because my mother was having babies once every year. I'm one of 10 children and I'm the second. And so therefore, my mother was always home.
We're conducting an interview for the Ivy City History Project. And my name is Ingrid Drake, and I'm interviewing, and so is...
Antoine Williams.
And...
Marcus Cruz.
And...
Ivan Blake.
And we are interviewing today...
Clifford Colson, an old-time Ivy Cityer. We lived on Capitol Avenue, 1829. Had a big house on Capitol Avenue, right just around the corner. And I don't care where you come from,
we're just gonna move on up. Ivy City could have been a slum, not only a ghetto, but a slum. But it wasn't a slum for the simple fact that, let's say if you needed plumbing or something, and you knew that my dad had a snake or something, and you'd come over like, Mr. Ray, can you help me out? And my dad would say, well, what can you do for me? You know, well, maybe this guy can fix the cars or something.
The child life up there was good, the child life, because people, especially in her up there where she lived, they lived in those two big frame houses up on a hill. You know, they had pear trees, apple trees, people had peach trees, and there's Patterson Woods all around us where Gallaudet College is. All that back there was nothing but woods. And we used to go pick blackberries and strawberries. We just had a ball up there. And when it snowed, we could come down that alley on them sleds. We could go to the grocery store right down the street. What was the name of the store? I can't think of that. Bands, right there in that little store. You could buy 5 cents worth of sugar. You could buy 5 cents worth of flour. You could buy, my father used to send us down there, he could get 3 cigarettes for a penny.
Nicey, Dorothy Lorraine Scott. Everything was just beautiful in Ivy City. I really enjoyed Ivy City.
Ivy City, there's a long list of political activism in Ivy City, dating back from Perry Carson. I know that, I don't know if my grandfather had any political activism in him, but I know that they had a real estate deal together. I know that in Ivy City. I've seen their names on the deed, so that's a fact.
Every May 1st, we had May Day. It was a beautiful, out on the beautiful ceremony, right out on the school playground, where we, you know, went around and we were dressed in white and everything. And of course, they stopped because of the association with May Day and Russia. Is that what it was? Is that what stopped it?
I think when I was 6 or 7 years old, I got a job going to store for people, making money. Oh, I was some money. And, but everybody just loved me. Even the store people, the pharmacy, they knew me, my sister and I. And every time we got sick, my daddy would send us over there and he'd fix up that medicine for us. Then when I went to school, I would buy pickles and the teacher would have the math class first and then the English class second. The boys would steal my pickle while I was up in math class. I would smell it and cry.
Did you have a great childhood?
A beautiful childhood. Moving out here in this area, we had a lot of wild fruit, cherries, peach trees, blackberries, plenty of room to run and play baseball, ride bikes. So it was like moving to the country when I moved out of Northwest, out here.
I was in the Boy Scouts at Bethesda Baptist Church. We was in Troop 517. Our troop master was Mr. Crow, and we used to parade in Ivy City on special days, and we used to parade around the schools, and I was taught all good things by Mr. Crow about the Boy Scouts.
The big force in this community was the Civic Association, the Trinidad Civic Association, and Mr. Crow, as I think I mentioned before, was really the founder and the driving force.
When you was young, was you a baseball player?
I was there, but I wasn't that great. So they let you, you know, come in and play just to give you something to do so you wouldn't be hanging out doing nothing. But everybody played, but not as good as other guys.
Only you can save me. My life, it was you. Kiss me, drive me crazy.
After you leave from Ivory City, we kept in touch with some of the, we always kept in touch with some of the friends that we could, we were very close to.
You say you want my baby. Girl, if that's a fact.
I think Ivory City should stay as it is. It should be renovated. And I think it should stay a residential area. You know, it would be a shame to make it a commercial, you know, make it a commercial zone, because, you know, so many people have roots there in Ivory City. And I would love to see Crummel School restored and make a historical museum out of it for Ivory City and for the people of Ivory City.
A family in Ivory City, those of us today, we were just like a family. We looked up after each other, you know. We could have, if your children were outside, you didn't have to worry because you knew that the neighbors were going to look after them. You didn't have to stay out there and watch them. My name is Sarah Hunter, Sarah Parker Hunter. My birthday is April the 9th, 1917. I don't know where I was when I was born, but I just know 3 months later I was in Ivory City. A pretty unique little place. Oh, yeah. Nothing but woods. Well, you know, it had trees and sycamore pear trees and blackberries and stuff like that. Poke salad, watercress. West Virginia Avenue was not West Virginia Avenue like you see it today. Mm-hmm. It was country. It was just plain country. It was just a unique country place.
We would go up there and lie down on the grass and watch the trains go by on New York Avenue.
Chickens and... Yeah, he used to raise chickens and hogs until they put running water in. When they put the running water in, he had to get rid of the hogs. You know, he couldn't have them out here anymore. The bottling factory was up that red building right there on the corner where they used to wash the milk bottles, you know. Years ago, when you got your milk, it was in bottles. Uh-huh. You might not have been born then. Well, they used to bring them here, out in Ivory City, to wash them. That was the bottling factory. And the way we earned extra money on Saturdays, we used to go up there and rack the bottles, as they called it, put them in the cases so they could go through the machine.
If you didn't play baseball or horseshoes, you were no good in the neighborhood.
I liked playing ball. I didn't really like dolls and stuff. I liked all the things the boys liked, baseball and stuff like that. On Mount Olivet Road, when it first opened, they would let us skate in the street. We'd go up and down the street, and of course, we rode our bikes.
And I would enjoy going up that road and then sitting back to enjoy coasting back down to my house, which was right there on Mount Olivet and Capitol Avenue. So that was lots of fun.
Then we used to have a little job at the drugstore. We used to, Montella Pharmacy, we used to ride the bicycle and deliver the medicine.
I used to help a man right there at Bethesda Baptist Church who had a horse and a buggy. He used to go over there at 4th and Florida Avenue at the market. And he would get groceries, potatoes, and things like that. And we used to ride with him and help him sell them. And then we'd go back, and he'd clean up his wagon, and he would let us ride around the horse on the lot right there where the church was.
And this part was our garden, where we had our garden. And you had to pay 25 cents for it. And then they had this man that came to our school that sold seeds for $1 a pack, and you bought whatever seeds you want to plant, string beans, tomatoes, squash, or whatever. And we would plant those. This was our garden for the summertime. Pay 25 cents for the plot. That's why I don't like gardening today. I don't like digging in the dirt, because one time I was doing it, and one of those big old green tomato worms got on my hand, and I've been scared. I'm scared to death of worms. And that was the end of gardening for me.
One Halloween, the fellas got together and had a little band, and they came round in the streets singing, came up Fenwick Street singing, "Show me the way to go home." I had a drink about an hour ago, and it went right to my head. And so they said, they were marching, "Show me the way to go home." A whole string of them was marching and singing. I thought that, I just laughed. I thought that was so funny. But they had the little horn. That's the type of, you know, things that they would do at that time. There was very little fighting between the groups, rival groups. And the boys would stand on the corner, though. They were good for that. But they didn't, they weren't bothering anybody.
My sister had a record player, a portable record player that you had to wind up. It played 45s and 33s and 78s, something that whoever's listening probably never heard of. But they were actual wax records, and she would have to wind it up. And my brothers used to sing doo-wop under the street lights, and all of the girls would be all silly and everything.
Bethesda Baptist Church played a great role in my life.
Say a little prayer for you. The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you.
My brothers was down to church. They went to the Methodist church up the street. And we would go there, but some reason or another, they were too dry, I thought. Me and Helen thought, I don't think we're going to like this. So we want to see what it is like down to the Baptist church. And they would sing, and oh, we liked that because we liked to sing ourselves. So every now and then, my brothers was down there, and they were singing, and they hadn't gotten married, but they soon found some wives. Two of them found wives there in the church. And we started singing also. We were the youngest things in the choir. The pastor said, let those girls sing if they want to. Why, sure, they little, they are younger, but they can sing. So we got in that choir, and we stayed there. I'm still in it.
My mother was always a very staunch member and part of the church, and my father too. My mother was Mamie Pinkett Bell, and my dad was Edmund Bell. My dad was a trustee and also treasurer for the church. My mom sang in the choir, and she was also president of the Flower Guild at one point.
The ladies, they would have little weddings, tom-thom weddings. You don't hear about them nowadays.
What is
that? Yeah, little folks would dress up like adults, you know, and that's what they call the tom-thom wedding. And they would have plays. One of the plays' name was The Dream of Queen Esther. That was good. I like that. We had male choruses. They would sing, and quartets. It was real nice.
When I first joined, it was just this little white church, and Reverend Willie Williams was the pastor. And he was one of those fire and brimstone preachers that scare you to death with what he preaches, you know. And I always tell people, I didn't join church because, you know, I really understood. I said, I didn't want to go to hell. He used to just preach so, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to. So I said, I don't want to go to hell. So I went up and joined.
We had an annual summer picnic with our pastor. He was very instrumental in providing a lot of leadership and a lot of guidance for the community. And this trip would always take place in the summer, and everybody, every family would prepare their food, chicken and good potato salad, and also corn and watermelon. And we would always go to a beach that was called Sparrow Beach. At that time, we were still faced with some aspects of segregation, and that was the beach where, and they called it at that time Colored Beach, rather than, it wasn't called Negro or Black Beach. But we had no concern about going to any other beach because that was all we knew. And when we got to that beach, we had such a great time sharing the food, sharing the fun, and frolicking in the water, and renewing all of our values and our fellowship.
Deacon Lewis W. Crow, I will never forget him. Yes. And then, of course, Aaron's grandfather, Deacon Enoch Gray, of course, you know, he taught at Crummell. He was a teacher there. And then he was a member of Bethesda. He was one of the deacons of Bethesda Baptist Church. So all of those deacons had, you know, they had a great play in your life because they were exemplary.
Brother Crow and the group of them would mention those things about the civil rights program and what we should do and, you know, read more and things like that so we would know what to do if we ever had an encounter with anything. And it was all interesting to us because we, whatever it was, we hadn't heard it before and it was something that we would like, so we would pay strict attention to what they were saying and try to get the books and try to read them and whatever, what. So it's something that, you know, you get used to, and but when things start opening up to you and you start spreading out a little bit, you wonder, well, how in the world did you you get so confined to these things?
Segregation really didn't
affect us that much because we had everything we needed right in Ivy City, no matter what it was. Like I said, we had grocery stores, dry cleaners, laundromat, barbershop, recreation. We had everything there. So when the schools were desegregated, it really didn't matter because we were going to all black schools anyway.
We had a good time in primary school. I was what you call one of them, you wouldn't say a genius, but I would say I was considered one of the smart ones in primary school as I went along. Myself, Benny King, Yvonne Taft Scott, Yvonne Carvin, Gloria Taft Scott, and Elizabeth Hall. We all skipped two grades in primary school. That's how smart we were. But I thought I was smart, but I wasn't smart. My mother was smart. She went there before I did. And I caught one of the same teacher named Miss Browner, was the principal of the school. She taught my mother and taught me. And she would get that, and she would get to me and would tell me, "Alfred, you didn't know that." She said, my mother's name was Isabel. She said, "Isabel would have knew that."
Well, my major profession was in education, and I studied to become a teacher. My second grade teacher, Mrs. Taylor, and she was working on some kind of project with Howard University, and she was going to the library there, and I had never been to a university, and she took me there with her to deliver some books, and while we were there, she kind of gave me a little tour and talked about some things and talked about the campus as we rode through the campus. And that really did have a great influence on my life. Mrs. Adams, Travola Adams, had a great influence on my life too. And I am sure that had a significant role in terms of determining that I would go into education.
My name is Eleanor Dade Grant. And I lived at 1943. Capitol Avenue, Northeast. I was a teacher first, then I was a counselor, then I was an assistant principal, and then I was principal. Crummel School really was the place where almost everyone in this area attended school. And the history of the man who Crummel School is named after was very important in terms of the progress of Washington, D.C. area.
When we left school at 3 o'clock, we would go back to our neighborhood on Montel Avenue, and there were a group of young people, including me, who would gather little children and teach them. Now, we've already been in school all day, and then we're gonna play school after 3 o'clock. And Marva says that has been one experience that she has not forgotten. She said when she got to kindergarten, she could read. She could. It was in the Colvin's basement, Vashti and Yvonne and Petey. We sat there in their basement and taught these little kids how to read and write.
Well, it was very nice school. It was great. We had great teachers. And in those days, your teachers would come to your house. If you didn't do your homework or if you didn't turn your homework in, your teachers wouldn't call on the phone. They would knock on your door and sit down and talk to your mother or your father or your grandmother, somebody like that. So it was a great school. I think we got a pretty good education there for what was available to black people at that time. These
arms of mine. I can remember a big snow one, and I must have been about in the first grade. And I could not, my mother and dad were discussing about the weather and discussing about getting to school, because if I look back at my report cards, which I still have some of those report cards, I always had perfect attendance, most of, unless I was really ill. But at any rate, my mom decided that, well, she does not have any galoshes or shoes to cover to go through the snow. And I can remember my dad were taking me to school and putting me inside of his big coat. He didn't have very good shoes either. But I can remember it was so important that I got to school, that my dad picked me up and put me in his big coat and walked me to school through the snow. And he was back there to get me at dismissal time.
That was our beginning. Crummell Elementary School, our meeting place, our educational foundation. Come on!
Okay, of course I was young, but I met a lot of people. They were friends, and we still communicate now. Let's say after, 50-some years.
Of course, I have a best friend that went to Crummell School with me now. We've been friends for 40 years.
Elaine Smith.
Jackie Council. They always had parents and the kids would go on this TV show. Can't even remember the TV show. My mother would, of course. And they would play in these trivial games and win money for the school. And Crummell was fortunate enough to participate in that television show for about 2 or 3 years consecutively.
Joe McPherson. I was born July the 20th, 1973. I lived in 1947 Capitol Avenue, Northeastern, here in Ivory City, born and raised. They had like talent shows. I remember one year, me and my twin brother and another friend of ours, we got our outfits together and, you know, we performed a song. They had, like I said, live bands, live go-go bands. You know, they had those people come out and play in the summertime.
My name is Daisy Roden. I'm going to read a paper that my sister prepared on her sojourn through Crummell Elementary School. Her name is Marva Roden. We read and sang about exotic locations beyond our borders, took imaginary trips to faraway places, and began to dream of possibilities far beyond Ivy City, where our little segregated school was located. My interest in world geography was born in this environment when we sang about those faraway places with strange sounding names. I knew that I wanted to visit those places, and eventually I did join the Foreign Service and got a chance not only to visit, but to live in many countries around the world.
The O'Briens, Tillman O'Brien, was the mayor of Washington, D.C. He went to Crummell. Leon Hawkins, who was the first black law clerk downtown, went to Crummell. My name is Rametta Cornelia for the C. Freeman.
I began to get tough, said I want you to come back, come back, come back.
For the neighborhood kids, there's really nothing for them around here, because I remember we used to play on the playground, the school, I think it's fenced in now. It was a shelter, and someone told me there were raccoons in the school.
See, when I left Ivy City, it was right after they did away with clauses in real estate where certain races couldn't buy certain places. And that's when we moved at that time.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go?
I was born in 64, so I grew up in interesting times. I remember D.C. burning, and in fact being in Ivy City when it happened, and My parents, of course, were divorced. By then, I remember my dad running by in his then-fashionable Volkswagen Beetle and offering to take me and Mamita and my mom out of Ivy City. And they said no. You know, we were fine over here.
Actually, I think that's when things started kind of going downhill, right about that time. There was looting, and looting is when you break in a store and steal everything in the store. There was looting going on. And the people who owned the stores, they had to close down for maybe 2 or 3 months. And then they did come back eventually. But that was how the riots affected Ivy City. But as I said, it only hurt us because for maybe 3 months we didn't have a store.
What we did was hurt ourselves, I think, in that we destroyed the neighborhood when we should have been down there destroying where the Capitol was or somewhere, you know.
I remember Mom and I sitting on the front porch and the National Guard going up and down, tanks on Providence Street, if you can even imagine it, and they said, get back into the house. And my mother said, well, it was so hot. We didn't have air conditioning. So hot. She said, all we want to do is just get a breeze. We're not going to leave the porch. And as you can see, we had a fence as well. I said, get back in the house. And my mother had arthritis and couldn't move as fast as the guy wanted. He threw a tear gas bomb right on our porch, and my mother almost couldn't make it in the house. She became overcome because my mother had allergies and respiratory problems too. And I had to get her in the house. Her eyes were just burning and everything. Yeah, it was a mess.
All things and what they used to be oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
During the riot, it just seemed like we hurt ourselves as a people, especially with the burning of H Street Northeast. That was like our shopping oasis because, I don't know if you know or not, when I was younger, we couldn't go to Hex, we couldn't go in Woody's, we couldn't go in Woodward and Five and Dime, we couldn't go to Landsberg. We couldn't even drink water out of the fountains in the park down there. So we made our own downtown, which was 8th Street. You know, rumor always saying that there were other people who didn't live in the district and didn't have the devotion of and the loyalty toward 8th Street. They burned 8th Street, but, you know, you'll never know. You never know, because they blame CIA on everything, FBI on everything. But you don't know, because we're learning now in our history that they did have a lot to do with a lot of things. We wanted to get a Black Panther organization started here in Ivy City because they did a lot of good work. A lot of people associate Black Panther with negativeness, but they were all positive. They didn't want liquor stores on every corner. They wanted, they promoted entrepreneurship and a lot of very good civic and social things. But the thing I guess that got them is when they began to arm themselves, no different than the Klan. But it seemed like they were focused, they were sought after, and they were destroyed.
Describe the neighborhood and how it has changed over time.
I hate to say this, but the difference is drugs. See, there was no such thing when we were coming along. We didn't know anything about it. You know, we had a few neighborhood winos, you know, and that's it. But there was no such thing as drugs. Unfortunately for the children growing up now, and that's something that they have to deal with. See, we never heard a gunshot. Never. We didn't even know what it sounded like.
Yeah.
How old are you?
9.
And how long have you been living around Ivy City, man?
For like a couple weeks, months, years, I guess.
Couple years?
Yeah.
And do you like Ivy City?
Not that much, but yeah.
Why you say you don't like Ivy City that much?
Because it's not a good place to be when you're young at the age. You shouldn't be living in there, such a bad place. When I moved around, I thought it was a good place, but then when they started showing people getting killed, I didn't want to live here.
So when you was coming up, you had very bad memories, such as?
Like, I had bad memory, like, for people to be dying. It's not a good thing.
Do you think this can be a better place to live?
I guess if people stop killing people for no reasons.
Great answer.
Drugs were getting bad anyway when I was coming out of school in 71. But it was heroin, and most people wasn't as stupid as they are with the crack stuff. Most of us didn't bother with the heroin for fear of needles or just fear of being like the heroin addicts we saw. But the drugs came in like a swarm of lotus and just seemed to consume most of the people who had stayed. And then you got that whole generation walking around like zombies and not paying attention to their children, and it was just a mess.
You know, it's a lot of people that came and went in this neighborhood, you know. And, you know, people, you know, start working and stuff like that and get their lives together, and they moving out the neighborhood because they see how this neighborhood is. It's not right now. This is not a great place for someone to raise a family in this neighborhood because you don't have anything in this neighborhood for a child. You basically, you know, keep your child in a house.
My best friend that was here when I was here, grew up together, she moved away, and that was just, that was my bestest friend in the whole wide world. And that was the only girl, I mean, we still best friends now, but she moved away. And once she moved away, I started hanging out with, you know, people that really weren't into, you know what I'm saying, doing stuff that wasn't on the right path as me. And basically, you get bored, and you don't have nothing to do when you start just doing anything.
Erica Cruz.
Clarence Davis, I'm 14. I would like for it to look a little more better, so that children, a lot more children out here playing, not that much violence going on around here.
Oh, my name is Veronica.
And how long have you been living around Ivy City, man?
Oh, I've been here like about a year and a half.
Do you think the community could be a better place for our children and for people around here?
Yeah, there's some improvements that need to be made, like as far as the housing, affordable rents, and activities for the kids, because they really don't have like nothing to do, and they just like do the same thing all the time. Besides, if they out of school or whatever, they don't. It's some activities for them, but it need to be more.
The Crum Mill Recreation Center was a vital. It was like the heartbeat, and it had a daycare, a thriving daycare center, a senior center. Just everything that the community needed, it was right there. And when they closed that down, the community wasn't being serviced anywhere else. So the community died.
If you're a community of people that has no outside support, if the city government is not really trying to support you, and in fact, if they're doing things that harm the quality of your life here, like closing Crummell School, like having vacant lots, like letting people dump garbage without doing anything about it, like putting a nightclub in the middle of a residential neighborhood, all of these things are not the fault of Ivy City residents.
Hello, everybody. My name is Susan Craver, and I moved into Ivy City in 1976. Excuse me, I'm a little emotional. And I was the first preschool director of the Ivy City Preschool. We opened in November of 1976 in the small trailer that was to the right of the Crummell Schools. We saw that school rise again. And we even had someone from the White House when we dedicated the Crummell School complex back to the community in the spring of 77. And I know you can do it again. And I'll be standing beside you because I've seen it come back once. I know it can come back again.
When I moved back, which was probably October of 2004, I think it was either that, it was like that month, like immediately after coming back, there was either a notice in my mom's door or on my vehicle, or somehow somebody said something, and they're buying the properties and you gotta look out and this and that. And then I started attending the meetings and immediately saw, you know, what was needed. There's a lot of concerned residents. A lot of them are older.
The job of a community organizer anywhere, but like in Ivy City, is to build relationships with people and to assist people with having information that they need in order for them to be able to stand up and fight for their rights.
I met Parisa Nerusi when they were flyering the Ivy City a couple of years ago about an event happening at the Arboretum. I think that's when I first met her, through Charles Brown, who was my next door neighbor, who's gone now. And then from there, it's just history, because anyone who knows Miss Nerusi, they know that she's like a Tasmanian devil for civil rights.
I moved to D.C. in August 2000, so this is my 6-year anniversary being in D.C., and about 9 months into living here, I started working for a group called Friends of the Earth, and they had a program called the D.C. Environmental Network, and I was working on local issues for D.C. Environmental Network, and we had a monthly luncheon where people would come and talk about a different topic, and this gentleman came, named Mr. R.V. Parks, who is the president of the Ivy City Trinidad Citizens Association. And he was talking about, I was trying to help him get some tires and things that had been dumped in the community removed. And I ended up spending a lot of time with him, and he took me around the neighborhood and told me about Crummell School and the work he had been doing. And he's the one that introduced me to Ivy City. And then I ended up working with him as a volunteer and supporting him with the Civic Association's efforts to get Crummell.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. President Trump has lashed out in anger against Israel and Iran after a ceasefire he orchestrated between both countries seemed to grow more fragile. He said, and I quote, "We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the expletive they're doing," end quote. The president expressed unhappiness in particular toward Israel, who violated the ceasefire today before it was supposed to take effect by striking a radar site north of Tehran, following accusations that Iran had fired several missiles at Israel. However, after Trump held a, quote, firm and direct call with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this morning, sources say that Israel refrained from conducting further strikes on Iran. In a ruling yesterday, the Supreme Court sided with the Department of Homeland Security by granting President Trump's emergency request to resume deporting migrants to countries other than their homeland with minimal notice. The 6-3 decision temporarily blocks an earlier decision by a lower court judge who ruled that migrants must be allowed due process before any third country removals. The three justices who dissented were Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. In their 19-page dissent from their fellow justices' decision, Justice Sotomayor wrote that the ruling was, quote, "gross abuse and exposes thousands of migrants to the risk of torture or death." She also said that by granting Trump's request, the Supreme Court was rewarding lawlessness and undermining due process, which involves following set legal procedure so that no person will experience prejudicial or unequal treatment. The 2025 Atlantic hurricane season started on June 1st, and now the first storm of that season has been named Tropical Storm Andrea. Andrea formed this morning in the open Atlantic Ocean between Bermuda and the Azores, which is a region in Portugal. As of 11 a.m., Tropical Storm Andrea was about 1,400 miles east of the U.S. East Coast, with maximum sustained winds of 40 miles per hour. The storm is forecast to move northeast at 17 miles per hour.